Sponsorship of this KQED podcast is provided by California College of the Arts, offering extension courses focused on design, fine arts, and digital technology. Campuses in Rock Ridge, Oakland, and Potrero Hill in San Francisco. cca.edu/extension.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in for Dave Iverson. Coming up on Forum, an hour with one of America's greatest travel writers, Paul Theroux. His traveling started in the early 1960s, and books followed soon thereafter. Now, with over 40 books to his name and 50 years of traveling the world, he's written a book on what he calls his ultimate, as in his last, African safari. It's called The Last Train to Zona Verde. We'll talk about the book, about traveling, writing, and Africa. Stay with us for all that on Forum. From KQED Public Radio, good morning and welcome to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson, in today for Dave Iverson. Travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux has been bringing the world into people's homes for 40-some years now. His novels, set throughout the globe, tell stories of places he has known firsthand. His travel writing covers epic journeys. The Great Railway Bazaar, published in 1975, carried the readers along with Theroux as he traveled by rail from London to Tokyo. Overland trekking became his signature style, and books that followed included The Old Patagonian Express, A Trip from Boston to Argentina. Travels in China were reported in the book Riding the Iron Rooster, and readers could glimpse at the remote Pacific through his book The Happy Isles of Oceania. And what seems to be his first and great love is Africa. Several of his books, both fiction and travel, revolve around his 50-year-old relationship with that continent. From early work set in Uganda and Malawi to his most recent book, The Last Train to Zona Verde, Paul Theroux shares his deep connection and affection with this vast landscape. He also tosses aside any rose-colored glasses and shares his unvarnished thoughts on the complicated countries he travels through, offering his insights on the realities of political corruption, cultural degradation, and international meddling by well-intentioned NGOs and celebrities he tags as mythomaniacs. Paul Theroux's books do more than just transport us and tell us stories. They also raise questions about travel itself, why we take to the road, and how travel can transform us. Paul Theroux, it's a real pleasure to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Penny. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, let's start by talking about the subtitle of your current book. You call this your ultimate African safari, and I have to think your traveling self, your writing self, was really born in Africa. And what is it about Africa, the continent, that has pulled you back over and over and has had you writing about it for so many years?
I first went to Africa in 1963 with a group of Peace Corps volunteers, a number of whom live in the Bay Area. And we're, after 50 years, we are still pals, returned PCVs. We see each other all the time. And I would say that's part of the of my life was meeting these wonderful people who became teachers in Nyasaland, which later became Malawi. So that was we joined the Peace Corps in 63, 50 years of – so that's life's great tapestry. You ask what is it about the country? I think first it was when I went to Africa, countries were becoming decolonized. So Nyasaland became Malawi the following year in 64. And to see a country become independent, it had a small population. It had a rudimentary school system. But it had a lot of spirit. And they made their money on tea mainly, selling tea and peanuts. And it actually wasn't doing too badly. If you have a small population and industrious people, you can make it. You know, any country can, really. But they ended up with a dictator. And so I observed the progress of a country under the thumb of a dictator who just wouldn't go away. 30 years later, he was still there. And so being up close to people who were so friendly to a political system that was so simple to things that were so obvious helped me see how the world worked, particularly the world of power, the world of community, and then how a place falls apart. So, you know, that's a great for a writer, and particularly the writer that I was, that was everything. And the main thing was I was far away from home. My advice to writers is always, if you want to be a writer, leave home, go away, go far, far, far away from your family. And that's where I developed that notion. So Africa was really the beginning of the making of me as a writer and the making of me as an individual.
And because it was the making of you as a writer, it was sort of your coming out moment, or your personal revelation about who you could be or what you might be or what the bigger world was. I'm wondering if it just became your touch point, if it became where you would go to check in and see how you were doing, see how the world was doing over decade after decade.
Yes. Yes. Africa did operate that way for me. I mean, well, first, there's a Jungian concept called individuation. You need to find out who you are. You become who you are by being on your own. You go away. I mean, we are ourselves, but we don't always develop ourselves until we go into some solitary experience and discover what our capabilities are, or the varieties of intelligence. But Africa was full of possibility. Parts of Africa are extremely wealthy. South Africa is extremely wealthy. The Congo, extremely wealthy. And then other places developed along. I mean, I was recently in Angola. This book is about traveling through Angola. Angola is floating on a lake of oil, like Nigeria, 2 million barrels a day. That's quite a lot. At $100 a barrel, do the math. It's billions, billions, billions a year. Billions. So you think, when you're young, you think, in 5 years, this could happen. If they strike oil, that could happen. If they find gold, that could happen. And when you're young and naive and you think that money solves problems and not governance, you have hope. And so I realized just what was happening to the world. Also, I mean, Africa became the focus of a lot of my views on corruption, my health, and wasted effort, because I felt to a large extent I was getting much more out of Africa than Africa was getting out of me.
Well, you go back to that over and over through all kinds of, through interviews and through your books, that travel to a place like Africa is more about building or sustaining or growing yourself than anything a traveler can offer to any local community.
Sometimes at the expense of the local community. I mean, people go to Africa to burnish up their reputation, to build a school or hold a malnourished baby and for a photo op, and they don't realize that they might be doing harm. I mean, but they're improving their image, but they're doing harm. And it's one of the features of the world is that people take vacations in countries where people are starving. I mean, they go to you name a country, name a warm equatorial country, and where there are luxury eco lodges and luxury hotels and great beaches, it's possible that not far from there, the infant mortality rate is very high. Access to education and hospitals is very low, and so in Africa has become like that. One of these is just Planet Africa, where things don't go well.
Some folks have honed in on your very critical eye of some of what's going on in Africa, whether it's international actions to try to benefit different local communities or countries, foreign aid, these people that you kind of consider mythomaniacs, the big super celebrities that are going in, diving in. And yet in the book, in this current book and in other interviews I've read with you in your writings, you don't consider yourself an Afro-pessimist. You seem to still have and hold a great affection for the continent. So how do you reconcile this very brutally real view of what's going on in all these different countries and your continued affection?
That's a good question. I say in the book is The Last Train to Zona Verde, and in which I travel from Cape Town to the north of Angola. I had previously traveled from Cairo to Cape Town on Dark Star Safari, and I didn't. There are places where you feel pessimistic and have every reason to feel that way about a place. But when you're thinking of a whole continent, and particular big, green, empty continent, you can't write it off. You can't. You have to say, it is so rich. First, it has resources that the whole world wants. It has people that the world wants. I mean, people who will work. It has all that possibility. It has not only commodities, but it has food. It could feed the world if it wanted to. It could even feed itself if certain things happen. So you can't be pessimistic because it's not finished. It's still, after all these years, after 50 years ago, people were saying Africa has great potential. It still does.
Well, and it's still within 100 years of being post-colonial, so there's still a lot of time to hash these things in.
Yeah, but yes, and the reason is it is post-colonial in some respects, but it's neo-colonial in other respects. China is looking at Africa. China is, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands. China might have 500,000, might have 1 million people of its people in Africa, doing everything, making plastic chairs for themselves, making cinder blocks, running copper mines, growing tomatoes. They're the little colonizers. It's the secret colonization of Africa. Now, I have no objection to that. If Africans agree to it, they agree to it. And the Chinese government has connived at it. But if Africa were so hopeless, why would these people be here, be there? They see hope there. They see possibility there. And they see tremendous opportunity that they don't see in China. So if Africa were hopeless, that wouldn't be the case. People would, they'd be treating it like Chechnya or Dagestan. They're not going to go there. You don't find many people settling in Chechnya or other parts of the world that are regarded as pretty hopeless. I don't feel. I think Africa in general, if you're going to make a generalization, is pretty badly governed. But if that were different, I don't know, might take changing human nature, but there might be more possibility.
Talking this hour with travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux about his new book, The Last Train to Zona Verde. And in it, he details his journey up the western coast from the southernmost tip deep into Angola. Paul Theroux is the author of over 40 books, including The Mosquito Coast, The Great Railway Bazaar, Servidia's Shadow, and more recently, In Set in Africa, The Lower River, and Dark Star Safari. If you'd like to join in the conversation, talk to Mr. Paul Theroux, give us a call at 866-733-6786. And you can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Well, I'm wondering, you've traveled so many different years and so many different stages of your life in Africa. And in this book, you decide at a certain point in Angola, you've hit the end of the line. You didn't necessarily hit the point that you were planning to hit. But is this the first time in a travel, that you've decided, you know what, I'm done. That's all.
No, I've been to a number of places. I went to Brazil. Let's say 15 years ago. And I thought, I want to wander around Brazil and perhaps write something. And I started traveling around Brazil and I realized this is not my place. I know people go to Brazil and they have a great time. It didn't work for me. I found it chaotic. I didn't speak the language well enough. I can speak Spanish pretty well. Portuguese eluded me. It's a gigantic place. I found it it wasn't my kind of place. And after about a month, I thought, I like being in Brazil, but I'll never write a book here. And so I wrote an article for a magazine about being in Brazil and drew a veil around the rest of it. So it didn't work. And, as far as Africa goes, it'd be great to be a gun-toting, person in a suit of armor who could go and do battle with the terrorists who are making trouble in Mali and Nigeria and other places. If I was well armed, let's say, and young and fearless, I would go and write about West Africa. But Mali is divided. It's at war with itself. Nigeria's the massacres in Nigeria have been going on for the past 2.5 years, the Boko Haram people. That's not for me. I mean, I don't carry a gun.
Are these different times? Because you were present during coups and during real political unrest in East Africa, in Uganda and Malawi, when they were breaking free and having independence movements. So what do you see when you see Mali and what's going on in West Africa that's so markedly different from what was going on in East Africa when you were watching all that?
In East Africa, I was a resident, and so was shooting in the 60s when there was a coup d'etat or attempted coup d'etat. A king was deposed. He's called the Kabaka, and there was fighting. So every day there was a curfew, and I lived there. I spoke the language. I spoke Swahili in Malawi. And so I managed. I taught classes. We stayed in, you know, at 6 o'clock at night. You had to be home. You couldn't be on the street. And there'd be shooting. In Malawi, there was a great deal of disruption at times. I saw people being beaten up. They didn't come after me. They were looking for each other. But it was political. And it was very, I mean, it's horrible seeing people attacked, seeing people massacred, hearing shooting. That's not good. But I lived there and I was habituated to the place. I was a resident and I understood more or less what was going on and I knew what to avoid. But to come in as to wander into Nigeria, to northeastern Nigeria, where the wearing of Western clothes, being perceived as a Christian, wearing glasses, carrying a book that's not the Quran, is perceived as a crime or forbiddenness. That's haram. That's a place you want to avoid. I mean, I'm a man past retirement age. Suppose I'm on a bus or a train in East Nigeria and the Boko Haram fanatics get on. They'll come for me first and I'll be beheaded. And that's not something.
There's not a lot of romance
writer,
in that storyline.
You know, you look for experience, but not that kind. You want to live to tell the tale. So that is a horrible thing. There are a lot of American, I won't say a lot, but there are some American academics who say that we're too quick to judge the Boko Haram. And they say that it's not really clearly understood. Well, I think that's BS. But, you know, there are sympathizers of the Boko Haram. These horrible people, I think. Anyway, Nigeria is a wealthy country. There's every reason to go there. But the Nigerians want to leave. And when you see people fleeing from a country, you think you might want to have a look at why they're leaving. But I'm not willing to risk my life to that extent anymore, to be that visible. And that's why it's my ultimate safari. I'm just... Someone else has to do it. Someone with a gun. Someone with a battalion of people. So, you know, someone in a group. Or maybe a really enterprising gonzo journalist. Not me.
Talking this hour with Paul Theroux. If you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. We have a couple of emails. John says, I took a trip to Egypt in the mid-80s for a month. Everything that could go wrong did. Unprecedented sandstorms, missing the Sheraton cruise down the Nile, stomach illness from hell. I couldn't even bear to develop the negatives after we returned. But as the years have passed, we've marked it as one of our greatest adventures. And Ramin writes, many years ago, I took a trip to Botswana. It would take 3 hours to describe what it was like in detail, but suffice it to say, it changed my life. I hope to go back someday. Botswana is indescribable. I want to point out, following up on Ramin, you call travel simply transformative. And going back to what you said at the top of the show about the individuation, there is something about travel and taking yourself out of home, away from home, that is, as Ramin says, it changes lives.
Yes, it does. And And the best trips are the worst trips, the hardest trips, the most laborious trips. A vacation doesn't transform you. I don't take vacations. I can't stand them. When people say, as they did when I took the Dark Star Safari trip, I remember I was in Egypt and I was at a place, the man said, you can relax here. I said, I really don't want to relax. I was at the time trying to get a ship or some kind of boat that went down to Eritrea. I failed. I ended up going to the Sudan down the Nile. But he said, no, come, you know, here, plenty food for you. You can relax here. You can relax. I said, I don't want to relax. Don't you understand? I don't want to relax. I'm not here to relax. You can get massage. We have spa. You know, I said, I don't want that.
Well, and you say, and it's funny because in some ways, folks characterize you as a crank, a bit of a crank about all these places. Oh, he grumbles about this and he complains about that and he says that this isn't nicer. But I have to say, I mean, that is the very thing that in the writing I think it comes off the page that you love the place. You love the gritty, grimy complaining that you're doing because it is the very thing that you just said. It brings you to life. It is the difficult journey.
I don't think I'm particularly a complainer. I don't even think you can see I'm a smiling hobbit-like person.
But your book, you do relay. You'll relay the gritty, grimy,
yes,
horribleness of what's in the bottom of the bucket. And yet, at the same time, as a reader, I can feel that you get a kick out of it.
Well, here's the thing. How do you make yourself free in any respect? How do you make yourself free? The answer is simple. See things as they are in life. Anyone listening to this program, see things as they are. Your wife, your husband, your children, your street, your neighbors, the government, what we're doing in Iraq, what we were doing in Afghanistan, the way people live in Africa, the way people emigrate, why people come to this country. See things as they are, not as you want them to be, not as you wish they were, but as they are. And so in writing, it may come off as complaints, but describing things as they are has been my motto as a writer. So when I started out doing it, I realized, you know, it's an amazing thing. If you write about things as they are, if you see things fresh with your own eyes, not influenced by anything that you've read or what your mother told you, then your writing sings and your writing has value. If you see things as they are.
And this is why it comes to me that you must be such a proponent of traveling alone.
Yes, because when you travel alone, if you're traveling with someone, they call your attention to things and they see things their way. And that somehow influences you. Also, when you're alone, you're lonely. And a degree of loneliness is quite helpful to inspiring this observation. When you're insecure, you are very alert, and when you're nervous, you're very alert, and when you're alert, you remember things.
And you're also open to interaction. You're open to having people come up to you.
Yes, yes. Hey, Mister, come with me. You say, oh, okay. Oh, it's so interesting, sir. Okay, fine. If you're with someone, they say, well, I'm hungry. You're the person. I'm hungry. Let's go back to the hotel. If you're alone, you say, well, okay. Let's have a look.
Talking this hour with travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux about his new book, The Last Train to Zona Verde, which details his journey up the western coast of Africa and deep into Angola. And Paul Theroux, known for many, many books, many set in Africa, but also set all over the world, including India, Asia, South America. And if you'd like to join in the conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. Going to go to a short break now. I'm Penny Nelson, sitting in for Dave Iverson. You're listening to KQED Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Penny Nelson in for Dave Iverson, and we're talking with travel writer and novelist Paul Theroux about his latest book, The Last Train to Zona Verde. I want to mention also that Mr. Theroux will be appearing at Book Passage in Cortamadera tonight at 7 o'clock to discuss the book and also probably to discuss many of the other books that folks might have read, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, Dark Star Safari, and The Great Trainway Bazaar. So show up at Cortamadera if you'd like to speak with Paul Theroux yourself. Before we go to the calls, I want to just talk about one more thing. You have, throughout so many different books, the topic of border crossings, the topic of borders, the topic of walking, being on the ground, really comes through. And I had to notice in this book, boy, that Angolan border was not a pleasant place for you. And being a person who has been loyal to the border crossing, first of all, what is it about borders and what was so different about this last experience?
Well, all borders are like going through the looking glass. It's never the same on the other side. And the border itself is different from the country. So, yeah, going from Namibia, walking from Namibia through a mass of people, being hassled and getting into Angola was an introduction to Angola, but to the real Angola. It's not the red carpet that you get in the international airport in the capital. So people go to Angola. In fact, I met Joe Stieglitz, he's a Nobel Prize winning economist. He said, I was in Angola giving a talk. I said, when was that? He said, last year. I said, you have a good time? Oh, yeah, it was great. You know, he had hosts. He gave a talk, Nobel Prize laureate. He was flown in. He gave his talk. He flew out. He said, what did you do? I said, I took a bus in Namibia. I got pushed around and I eventually got to the other side and hassled. And he said, our experiences were so different. We're about the same age, by the way, and he's a good guy. But
explain, when you talk about this no man's land, for most people haven't crossed a border, walked across a border, been, you know, rickshawed across a border. What is a border? And for all of the many folks who haven't done this, and what is this no man's land?
The no man's land is, right, people tend not to build very close to a border because or they build, let's say, certain kinds of businesses next to a border, but they tend not to have communities. There is a big difference. I wrote a piece for the New York Times last year about going across from Nogales, Arizona to Nogales, Mexico. And that really that is one of the most dramatic border crossings imaginable. It's not like Tijuana. There's a fence. You drive, you park your car, and there's a turnstile with a wall. It's a 40-foot steel wall that you cannot see through. So it's a bit like the Truman Show. Do you remember? And there's a wall enclosing. So there's this American wall, which is our border. And I went up. I said to the guy I'm going across. I said, have you been over there? He said, why are you going over there? I said, I'm just going to have a look. I said, have you been over? And he said, no, I wouldn't go there. The American policeman.
And truly just through the door.
Yeah. Through the door, through a turnstile. You walk in, suddenly you're in Mexico. 10 steps through, you're in Mexico. It smells different. There's smell of food, of Mexican food. The traffic's different. The people are different. The look of the place is different. But I've walked 10 steps through a wall. Well, in Africa, it's more chaotic. Borders tend to be mountain ranges, rivers, riverbeds, dry riverbeds. In Africa, they tend to be – it's probably a river. It's probably a riverbed or it might be a desert. So going from – you're going to a different place. I mean, people often – well, they speak Afrikaans in Namibia and Portuguese in Angola, as well as Ovimbundu, their own language. So there are Africans who are the same tribe on both sides, but the national language is different.
Well, and it's also the question of who would cross the border. Like why? What? Who is the person that is crossing the border? So a person that is choosing
most
to cross the
mostly border. They're people who are trying to get out, but there are also people trying to get in. Business opportunities,
commerce.
Fleeing. There's also always people on a border in Africa who are trying to get either in or out, who live on the border, who just live in the most miserable way. There are no great towns. There are no great cities on African borders. They're the most miserable, but they're the most representative of those in the country. I think walking across any border, anywhere in the world, is one of the great experiences that you can have. It's almost a metaphysical experience. And it could be from India to Pakistan, which at the border is called Wagga. And that's another, it looks the same on the map. The people look pretty much the same, but it's different. And you're interrogated. Going from Vietnam into China, great border. There's a river, the Red River. And you're going from an enemy, a traditional enemy of China into China, you know. And Cambodia.
The most honest caricature of or characterization of a place, I guess, is where, I mean, that would be what you're up against.
If you want to know what the country's really like, you cross the border and see, and the first people, the way you're treated, and the first people you see there, they're the outliers, let's say. They're at the fringe of it, but they're very representative of what the heart and soul of the country is like.
All right, let's go to some of the callers. Bill is calling us from Lafayette. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I've read your books, sir, and I have enjoyed them very much for a long period of time. I was a volunteer staff member in the Peace Corps in India in the 70s, and I've traveled in the Pacific Islands. And one question I've always had when I read your books is, how does this guy pack to travel for extensive periods of time and not be lugging a huge suitcase like I seem to be always doing?
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thanks, Bill. It's nice to talk to you. And, you know, congratulations on your service, Peace Corps service in India. I traveled through the Pacific. I had a boat with me. I had a folding boat. I had a Klepa kayak in two bags. I had a duffel bag with stuff in it. And I had some clothes. So I had four bags. The boat, camping equipment in a duffel bag, and then, you know, bathing suit and stuff. And I carried that an island group, the Cook Islands, Tonga, New Guinea, the Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, Easter Island. I took it all around. You said, how does it? And I remember.
What do you do about your writing material? You don't carry a computer, right? You don't take any tech with
you. No, I don't carry any electronic. Anything that needs a battery, unless it's just a little shortwave radio, I don't carry.
But write en route.
Yeah, scribble in notebooks, and I still write in longhand. But Bill was asking, he carries a big suitcase. I have a small suitcase. In Africa, I had a duffel bag, and a briefcase. In fact, the briefcase is made here in San Francisco by Glazer Designs. It's a beautiful leather. I mean,
but it sounds like from what I read, you have some used clothes and you often leave them where you at
the
last spot.
Yeah, you don't need clothes. I'm not meeting the prime minister. You know, I'm not there to open a school. I'm not there to spread sweetness and light. I'm just there as a ghost traveling through. I'm an old man in secondhand clothes with a $20 watch and $20 sunglasses. And they often get stolen. You know, you're welcome to them.
And you buy yourself.
I'm nobody. And if you, and that and so I'm not an observable person. I don't dress up. I don't wear shorts. People in Africa tend not to wear shorts. I mean, Africans don't wear shorts. They cover up their legs a lot of the time. But you can buy old clothes anywhere.
And you buy your cell phones on the road.
Yeah, I did it. I did this trip. You buy a cell phone. There's another $20 item. $20 and a SIM card. SIM card's $15. And you can throw it away. So throw away. Disposable. The secret of travel is disposable stuff or secondhand stuff.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go to Neil, who's calling us from San Francisco. Hi, Neil.
Hello. What can be done to promote democracy and human rights in Africa? And did you develop any attitude or opinions whatsoever about the Angolan civil war?
This is a really hard question, but a great question. What can be done to promote civil rights in Africa?
And democracy.
One is, don't encourage dictators. Don't encourage tyrants. You notice Gaddafi was overthrown in a spontaneous coup by his people, not by the British who are buying his oil, not by us who are doing business with him. Same with Mubarak, same in Tunisia. They were overthrown by their people.
But when you say that, when you say don't encourage dictators, how do we discourage dictators?
Don't do business with them. They'll do business with someone else. There's something called rogue aid. The Chinese will build anyone a bridge if they can get their stuff. So that's a problem. But we have been dealing, you know, Kenya's a pretty good example of our involvement with a very corrupt government. And we are heavily invested in Kenya. Our navy has maneuvers off the Kenyan coast. We have facilities there. And Kenya has had a very, very bad human rights record and a very bad, I know, they, you could say they just had an election, but it's a very corrupt government. And that's only one of them. Uganda has a very, very dubious government. You don't give aid and comfort to these people. The American Millennial Corporation gives money to countries. They cut off the aid to Malawi when Malawi began shooting demonstrators.
And they said,
you've shot 19 demonstrators. We're not going to give you this compact, this five-year, $350 million compact.
I'm sorry. Keep going.
And that's what needs to be done.
Neil, you had a question, though.
Since the Civil War?
He's what Neil's wondering also about the Angolan Civil War.
The Angolan Civil War is an absolutely a tangled mess. It started with it really started in the 60s, in 61, and it went on for almost 30 years. So one side, the MPLA won. I mean, you could say so. They were fighting. There were two sides, basically two sides, and the Cubans were fighting, were helping on one side, the South Africans on the other, and the South African side, supported side, lost. To the Angolans, it's a nightmare. The result of it is there are no wild animals in Angola. All the animals have been killed. There are no, they've been eaten, they've been blown up by landmines. There were 2 million landmines laid in Angola. About 68,000 have been uncovered, but there were 2 million down there. These landmines are made in places like China, Israel, and the United States. We got to stop making landmines and cluster bombs. So my feeling about the Civil War is the weird and wicked involvement of other countries.
Is what's causing so much harm.
Yeah.
Talking this hour with Paul Theroux, if you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email questions and comments to forum@kqed.org, and I'll read a couple of these now. Placido is asking, as a diplomat who was posted 4 times to African countries during my career, I listened to your talk with interest. Would you agree that much of the interest in Africa by countries is more because of self-interest and not because of genuine concern for Africa?
Oh, yes, self-interest. That's right on the money. That colonialism was self-interest. The Congo was actually owned by King Leopold of the Congo. It was his private place. That was his interest, to get rubber and to get ivory and, to control it.
Well, and this also plays to Neil's question. I mean, this idea of how to bring or help or promote democracy. You've, in lots of different settings, you've criticized international intervention, aid, all these different ways in which the international community, for their own purposes, has set back the African cause.
Yes. Henry David Thoreau said that if a man wishes – you see someone who wants to change the world, look deeply into that person and you'll see that there's something in that person's life that's not right, that there's something – they're trying to correct something in themselves. It's in an essay called Reform and the Reformers. And it's true that when you see someone trying to help Africa – take me for an example. I went to Africa because I was trying to get away from my family. And I wanted to do something positive. But I had very selfish reasons for going to Africa. And I think most people do. They want to help themselves. And, God bless them, because they can often do something positive. But aid hasn't worked. In 50 years since I was in the Peace Corps, we were training teachers in Malawi. They're still training teachers. Why 50 years after the fact are they still training teachers? Why aren't there enough teachers there? Well, one is they're poorly paid. Another is when people become teachers, they leave the country. But it's an amazing thought that that for 50 years they're training, they're doing the same thing. Something's wrong there, isn't it?
Well, when is aid damaging and when is it good? You, after all these years of watching, have you noticed trends?
That's a big question. But I would say that, first, humanitarian aid is a necessity. If people are starving, if people are really hungry, if there's a tragedy, you help them, as in Haiti or, earthquakes or things like that. But in general, aid doesn't do very much. Just it hasn't, like I say, it hasn't done very much in Africa. And a lot of it's misdirected. To build a school in South Africa, seems to me superfluous. South Africa has not only schools, it has great wealth. It has diamonds, it has gold, it has billionaires, millionaires. It's full of people who could turn the tide. And it hasn't happened there because other people are doing it. I think that you need to be met halfway. I think that funds have to be accounted for. You know, there's something called the World Food Program. I find that a very strange thing. The World Food Program gives food. Actually, they give it sometimes for humanitarian crises, but they give aid. They give food aid to Zimbabwe. Now, Zimbabwe is a country that hates the West, that has kicked out all its farmers, that used to be able
to
feed itself. It was a viable country. It's now being fed by the World Food Program. But not only that, India gets food from the World Food Program. North Korea gets food from the World Food Program. It's one of Obama's, you know, projects. He appointed the head of it. Drew Barrymore is one of their celebrity ambassadors. I'd like to look closely at who gets the food. Does the army get the food? Do the people who the food is intended for? Does Drew Barrymore go to North Korea as an ambassador and hold a little starving child? Or, you know, what is it all? What's it all about? It's a multi-billion-dollar program, it's there cranking along. So you say, what does aid do? I built a school, or at least an annex to our school in Malawi. I started working at the school actually in 64. I've gone back repeatedly. The school is not improving. So morale is a problem. But I would say aid works when there's good governance, when there's democracy. This question by...
And perhaps when there's self-interest among the African community that's local, when it's going to benefit directly.
When people believe in the government and want to stay and want to see how the system works and want to see how the process works, no, not people who want to go to Seattle to become a taxi driver or who leave the country. If the biggest difference between then and now is that I came to Africa at a time when Africans saw themselves, people in Malawi and Kenya and elsewhere, wanted to stay and see the process and live there, be educated, and saw that their lives were bound up with the country. The people that I meet now simply want to leave, and they have reasons for leaving because they're badly governed.
Well, we have another email. This one's from Robert. He says, he asks you, do you still kayak? He also says, keep up the great writing and great advice. Do you still kayak?
Yes, I was in Hawaii the other day, just a week ago, paddling my kayak.
I read in the New York Times that you, traveling has certainly not left your scope. And I was reading something I think you wrote earlier in the year about your next travel list includes stuff closer to home.
I've been traveling in the South. I've been traveling in Mississippi, Alabama, South Carolina. A lot of the problems that we face in rural America are the countries that third world countries face. You know, in Alabama, Mississippi, there are HIV problems, access to good education, to water, to schools. We have those problems. There are people in Mississippi who go on, missions to go to Africa to help Africans. They could very easily stay home and look at the Delta and see that the Delta is a place that's failing badly, that industry has left. In the middle of Alabama, the same. I've been traveling closer to home in the rural South.
In the rural South. Let's go to Zach, who's calling us from San Francisco. Hey, Zach.
Thank you for taking my call. In the last year, according to the BBC, there have been bombings at gay bars in Cape Town, South Africa. Are there any countries on the African continent where a gay person would feel safe?
Thanks, Zach.
That's a great question, and I don't think I can answer it. I would say an overt expression, let's say a gay couple was in Africa and showed an overt display of affection, they might find they attracted a very hostile crowd. Not because of traditional African beliefs necessarily, but because of the fundamentalist Christian beliefs that you'd find. Also, Islamic beliefs. So you're up against a lot of fundamentalists. You say, is there? I would say South Africa, although there've been there's been explosions in gay bars and there's hostility, South Africa might be one of the few where you could get information about gay-friendly destinations.
And it's a big city. I mean, it's a big.
I also think even the expression "gay-friendly."
I mean, I'm thinking Johannesburg
might be used there.
No, yeah. Cape Town.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that for all the trouble that there has been in South Africa, it might be the only place where you're likely to find a welcome.
All right. Well, you're listening to Forum. We're talking this hour with Paul Theroux. His new book is called The Last Train to Zona Verde. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Penny Nelson. Well, let's read a couple more notes that have come into us on a tweet. Christine says, Paul Theroux is clearly not a postmodernist. How does one divest oneself of all bias and see things only as they are? One cannot. Paul Theroux?
Well, that's a challenging question. No, I'm not a postmodernist. But to see things as they are, you see them as clearly as you can, to the best of your ability. And you try to divest yourself of as many prejudices as you can muster. I'm not an absolutist. The person who wrote it is challenging with that. I'm saying it's...
But that would be said of like any event, reading any book, you would bring, the author brings with...
Or writing. Let's say you're writing dialogue. I'm writing dialogue. If you write down everything in a conversation, everything that people say in a conversation, it's a very boring conversation. That there's the element of editing that goes on to write a conversation, as I do in this book. But to see things as they are, you need to sort of empty your mind. It's more of there is a Zen. It's not postmodernism, or it's not Jacques Derrida that we're talking about. It's more D.T. Suzuki. It's the Zen of seeing things as they are. It requires meditation, concentration, isolation,
and you do meditate.
Solitude.
You know,
yes,
in your
I do.
Book
I do
you,
meditate.
When you get
I do.
Up in the morning, you
I do.
Meditate.
So the challenge is, of course, I can't see you. There are things that I would miss, but it's the attempt. You have to try.
Paul writes, can you comment on your privilege as a traveler? Oh, no, this is Daffodil asking you, Paul, if you can comment on your privilege as a traveler. The vast majority of the world's population does not have the luxury to wander around the world indulging in and exploring countries the way Westerners do. Often their travel is the result of forced migration, as you well know.
Oh, yes, that's true. That's true. I said I was in Nogales. It's 10 steps from Nogales, Arizona to Nogales, Mexico. I was there a year ago. I wrote a piece for the New York Times. And I kept meeting people who had been thrown out of the United States. I met people who were yearning to come to the United States. And the United States was 10 feet away across a fence. It was 10. And these were people, you think I didn't feel privileged, thinking, well, tomorrow morning, I'm just going to walk through that door. But these people have to stay here for the rest of their life behind this fence and don't want to be here. They want a job. They want a life. And some have relatives across the fence. They have 10 steps away. So they feel, yeah, do I feel lucky? Very fortunate. I am the fortunate traveler in my life. I've had my health. I could go pretty much anywhere I could go. But more to the point, I can leave these places. I can get on a plane and come home. And in most of the places, they can't. That fills me with great humility. And I mean, it's a humbling thought to think that I can go anywhere, almost anywhere. Now and then, you know, people put up barriers. To go to Angola, you need an air ticket, you need a sum of money, you need a letter of invitation, and you need a ticket out. And you need a visa.
Well,
the obstacles to getting to Angola are unbelievable, unbelievable. But I could leave there.
But I did think that was interesting about Angola. They wanted to know why they wanted you to have a reason to be there. They weren't going to let you in like a lot of places. It seemed like you really did have to jump through more hoops.
Angola is not interested in tourists. The tourists-oriented places welcome you. They say, come, we'll give you a visa at the airport and, you know— and come and spend your money. They don't. Angolans don't want your money. They don't want your trouble. The hotels there are terrible, and they're not welcoming. The people who go to Angola are oil people, Chinese criminals. Chinese convicts serve out their sentences there and then are left. The big oil companies, the big mineral companies, those are the people. People will come and give them money and give them bribes. Give them bribes.
We only have a minute or so left. Are you working on writing now? Are you traveling and writing now, or are you working on novels?
What I'm doing is thinking about my next project, and I think it will be. I have a kind of open-ended, just traveling around the state, but traveling in the American South. I write every day, so I can't tell you what I'm writing, but I'm writing fiction. I wake up in the morning and I write. That's my meditative activity, right, among other meditative. But in terms of travel, yeah, I'd like to travel in the American South and see more of our own country and to see how it relates to other countries, because so much of what we face here is faced by other countries. There's a third world element in this country, an underclass in this country, which has a great deal in common with the poor all over the world.
All right. That's travel writer Paul Theroux. His next journeys are through the American South. And if you'd like to see or hear Paul Theroux, he will be at Book Passage in Corte Madera tonight at 7 o'clock to discuss his new book, which is called The Last Train to Zona Verde. Thanks so much for being with us.
Penny, it was a pleasure.
Thanks to Danny Bringer, our engineer this hour. And Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Dan Zoll is the senior editor. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Penny Nelson, here today for Dave Iverson. Thanks for listening. This is KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.